Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This episode is the edited version of a live session from the Jaipur Literature Festival 2021. Bill Gates, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. Bill Gates in conversation with Alok Sharma.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us. I'm Alok Sharma. I'm the president of COP26, the UN Climate Conference, which is taking place in the UK later this year. Welcome to this conversation with Bill Gates on his new book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, the Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. Thank you also to the Jaipur Literary Festival for hosting us. And today we will hear from Bill about his book and his climate work, before we move on to questions from the audience. But first, a short video to set the stage.
In a typical year, the world emits over 51 billion tons of greenhouse gases. And as we keep doing that, the consequences for human life will be catastrophic. When I first fell in love with computers as a teenager, they were enormous, expensive, and only the government and big companies could afford them. But my friends and I became obsessed with a wild idea. What could we do if there was a computer on every desk? And now the wild idea is quite tame. Billions of people not only have computers on their desks, but even in their pockets. Now the world needs another breakthrough. In fact, it needs many breakthroughs. We need to get from 51 billion tons to zero while still meeting the planet's basic needs. That means we need to transform the way we do almost everything. Our commitment to developing these innovations will mean the difference between a future where everyone can live a healthy, productive life and one where we're constantly dealing with the human and financial crises at a historic scale. Entrepreneurs and investors have to build new businesses and change existing businesses to get these solutions deployed. Government leaders have to enact new policies that drive the market for clean energy. And advocates have to keep their voices loud to hold all of us accountable for rapid progress. Avoiding a climate disaster will be one of the greatest challenges humans have ever taken on, greater than landing on the moon, greater than eradicating smallpox, even greater than putting a computer on every desk. And my basic optimism about climate change comes from my belief in innovation. It's our power to invent that makes me hopeful.
Bill, greetings from Nepal. And can I just say that I remember the first time I met you was in 2019, and we were at the Sainsbury Laboratories at Cambridge University. And we went to see some research which is being jointly funded by the UK government and, of course, your and Melinda's foundation. And it was research into protecting plants from the threat of climate change. And so you've been thinking for a very long time about climate change and funding it. So can I just ask you, in terms of this book, what prompted you to write this book now at this particular time?
Yeah, I remember when we were in Cambridge together and looking at the scientists working on getting plants to make their own fertilizer, which, of course, would help the poorest have enough to eat, and reducing how much fertilizer we make also reduces greenhouse gases. So, you know, that's exciting work where they're continuing to make great progress. Your question about why now is a good one, because I got worried about climate back in 2005 when I was traveling to Africa and looking at how the farmers were already having a tougher problem growing their crops, and realizing that as Africa electrified, you know, how would they be able to have lights at night or air conditioning without making the climate problem even worse? And sadly, it is Africa and the poorest subsistence farmers there who are already feeling the pain and will have the worst of it. In fact, millions of them will feel the need to migrate if we don't mitigate this problem. I gave a TED talk in 2010. It talks about innovating to zero. That's 5 years before I gave the pandemic talk. And then I was involved in the Paris conference in terms of getting innovation onto that agenda. But the thing that's really unique right now is that the younger generation is insisting we make this a priority. And I would have thought during a pandemic, you know, people don't think long term. They just think about near term things. But in fact, what we're seeing is that the younger generation is more energized than ever. And they're saying to politicians and all parties, you've got to show us that you take this seriously. And so this is a very special year. You know, your leadership of the COP, that will be a critical event. All these Build Back Better funds, the US, the UK, Europe, they're going to help bootstrap projects to take on some of the harder sources of emissions. And so I was going to come out with a book last year, but then the pandemic meant that wasn't timely. You know, I wanted to be before the COP, but fortunately the COP also got moved. So, you know, it feels very timely because we have this generation so committed to the cause.
Great. Well, I want to come back and talk to you about Paris and COP in Glasgow, but I just want to talk a little bit about this book itself. So I read it last weekend, and I have to say, I think it's incredibly accessible in explaining the key concepts around climate change. And you use some really interesting stats. You use this 51 billion tons figure. It's a key metric that runs through this book. Can you just talk a little bit about that and some of the other key metrics that run through this book?
Yeah, so greenhouse gas emissions, you know, if you convert them into CO2 equivalents, sadly, are just going up like this. You get little wiggles for economic depression, or, you know, the pandemic has brought them down somewhere between 5% and 10%. But you know, as the world's developed, we keep going up, and yet our goal is to go down. And so, you know, having that number 51 billion in mind allows you to look at any intervention and see as a percentage of 51 billion how impactful that is. The two other metrics that I'd love for people to take away from the book. One is understanding the sectors of emission. And, you know, that we've got a slide we could put up quickly here to show that. That shows people it's not just electricity and passenger cars. You know, transportation includes aviation. You've got agriculture at 19%, you know, heating and cooling 7%. But the one that people are probably the least aware of is the biggest slice there, which is that manufacturing piece that includes cement and steel. And in a way, we've over-focused, or well, not over, we put most of our efforts into the easier things like passenger cars and renewable energy sources. We also need to get going on the hard stuff, because if your goal is zero, you don't get to skip anything. The final metric that, you know, maybe we'll talk about more is this idea of how expensive is it to do things in a green way? And so I compare like buying a gasoline car to an electric car. And there the green premium, we can show this slide. The green premium is not that high. And because the volume has gone up and the competition is going up, that green premium over the next 10 to 15 years with cheaper batteries, better range, that will go to zero. Whereas for something like cement, you see that a ton costs almost twice as much. And so, you know, 51 billion source of emission, and the idea that this green premium is the metric that we have to drive down so that we can say to all the countries of the world, hey, buy the green stuff in 2050, and they won't push back because of the incredible increased cost that right now they would have to pay.
That's great. Thanks, Bill. Look, I think this is a pretty upbeat book. I mean, you didn't actually pull any punches about how difficult it is going to be to get to net zero. But on the other hand, you do set out solutions on the road to getting to net zero. And I very much share your view that I think technology is going to be very much part of that solution. So it'd be really great. I mean, you talked about electric vehicles just now, but can you highlight some of the other technologies which you feel are going to be part of our net zero future?
Yeah, the most mature would be the electric cars with the lithium-ion battery, the solar and land-based wind. Kind of in the middle are things like offshore wind. And there the UK is a leader in saying, okay, we're going to buy a lot of this. Who can give it to us at the lowest green premium? And the beauty of that is that then there will be innovation. You know, how do you anchor those things so they stay in the storm? And, you know, how do you connect the electricity? You know, that green premium has started to come down. And for the entire world, offshore wind, you know, I think can be a big thing. Electric buses, China's doing a lot of the pioneering work there, making sure that the cost and how they work when it's hot and cold, but the volume is going up. Then we have some things that are at the very earliest stages. And that's unfortunately where steel and cement come in, is that there's essentially no green steel or green cement today. And so we need to have not just more R&D money and more venture capital type money, but we also need buyers, you know, so we need governments, we need companies that are trying to contribute to society when they build new buildings to say, okay, we're going to buy green cement, and green steel, so that we can start down that catalytic learning path. And, you know, that how we bring that those kind of policies together, you know, I'm very excited that the COP will be a time where we can announce example projects that are under this catalytic catalyst framework. And so people can see that, okay, we really are trying and have a plan for every area of emission.
Yeah, so Bill, I mean, you talk about the fact that in the UK, we now, in fairly short order, have got the biggest offshore wind market in the world. And that's because we created a mechanism for investors to be able to invest. And I think that's kind of where we also need to be going with some of these other technologies. But you referenced COP. I'm spending a lot of my time traveling around meeting governments. And earlier this week, I was in Delhi and I met Prime Minister Modi. And during our conversation, he referenced mission innovation and he referenced working with you. And I think it'd be great if you could tell us all a little bit about mission innovation you know, how it came about and what we're trying to achieve with that.
Yeah, so prior to the 2015 Paris meeting, I was talking with President Hollande and President Obama and President Modi sort of saying, hey, the near-term commitments where you drive the low green premium stuff to higher scale, that is so necessary and so important. But that alone won't get us to zero. We need part of these conferences to look at, are we raising our R&D budgets and are we raising the high-risk capital that's going to jump in and grab those things out of the laboratory? And it was fantastic that President Modi, who actually named this initiative Mission Innovation, you know, he agreed to come to the entire event. And so we had the announcement. The government's committed to raise their energy R&D budgets. The UK's done very well in that, which is fantastic. Many others haven't met their doubling, but the total increase has been quite impressive. And my part there was to commit to this breakthrough energy effort that included a very specially designed venture group that would only go after climate innovation. And we've invested now in 40 companies. We've just raised a second $1 billion fund, which will invest in another 40 companies. And so that supply of innovation is going well. And I do give the 2015 conference credit for saying to people, it's yes, it's the near term, but it's also this innovation. And how we highlight some of these advances in Glasgow, you know, so people get that it won't just be brute force trillions of dollars. It will be creating new jobs around these new approaches that, you know, have other benefits like no local pollution, which, you know, coal plants have that. So, you know, that sense of, okay, how do we coordinate, you know, all the different green hydrogen projects that are out there and make sure we're picking things that really have a chance of getting to be very low cost. That's a super important topic because of all the money, the Build Back Better money, making sure we get the maximum benefit from that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you are so right when you say that we need to talk about green growth. I mean, in the UK, we use the statistic that over the last 30 years, we've grown our economy by 75% and cut emissions by 43%. So, yeah, it is possible, and countries around the world are doing it. But when it comes to transforming industries, and you talked a little bit about this earlier, and decarbonizing them, some, of course, are much easier than others. Have you actually been a bit surprised at which industries have moved faster than others?
Yes, the agricultural sector was the one that, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, I don't even really see the path there. And admittedly, we're still in early days, but there's a lot of companies like Impossible Foods, Beyond Meat, but many others as well, that are looking at new ways of doing food production that, you know, can get rid of the slaughtering animals and the methane and the manure and a variety of things that cause those to be highly emitting. So I'm seeing much more hope there. And, you know, that's why it's really the aviation fuel, the steel and the cement that, you know, sadly, just if you take those three, you know, you're up at almost 20% of emissions. Those are the ones that still don't get enough focus. So when we did our first Breakthrough Energy Fund, storage and food, actually, we had more opportunities than we expected. In our second fund, we'll really try and go after direct air capture, clean hydrogen, steel and cement, a lot more, because, you know, if your goal is zero, you have to hit all the different categories. You don't get to say, okay, that one's too hard. We'll, you know, not do it. And the industrial economy is, you know, everything is so cheap that people almost don't pay attention. And now, you know, we need to renew our skills and find new approaches.
So what are the toughest technological challenges ahead of us? I mean, what is going to make it really difficult to get to that net zero?
Well, one of the things that is tricky, and the United States is experiencing a little bit of this with our Midwest weather challenge right now, is that the electricity sector, even as it uses onshore wind, offshore wind, and solar, we need to maintain reliability. And even during crazy weather events like big cold fronts or heat waves. And that's going to mean that we have to build a lot more transmission, which is politically can be difficult to get permitted. It also is going to mean we either need to store a lot of energy for those tough periods, which would take a miraculous invention to be able to store that much, or up to 25% of our sources will have to be non-weather dependent and yet green. And that's where, you know, the question of is, can nuclear be cheap enough and safe enough? And can we get the public acceptance of that to be part of this energy ecosystem? It's a huge question. You know, we have to pursue both the storage miracle and nuclear to make sure that one of them succeeds, because, you know, the climate just accepting defeat on this would, you know, be so terrible for us. So I do think energy reliability, that's one where the open source model that Breakthrough Energy is doing will let people model the grid. David Mackay, who is part of the UK government, sadly passed away. He started this idea of, okay, let's get models going so that people can say, okay, which sources of energy do they like and how much transmission do they like? And in 2050, will it be cheap and green and reliable? So that's one that people may underestimate how tough the reliability will be, and yet it's so critical.
Thank you for that. And look, we've all been living through this unprecedented time over the last year through this pandemic. And actually, we've seen real urgency from many governments and scientists in the business community to support jobs, to support livelihoods, to support vaccine development and treatment development. It'd be quite interesting. Can you tell us your observations in terms of the approaches that have been taken to responding to the COVID-19 pandemic and the responses being taken to responding to climate change? What's the difference? Should we have the same urgency?
Yeah, I think they both are the same in that we rely on our government to have very smart people think out ahead for problems we might face. So, you know, because there will be earthquakes, we have building codes and we're willing to make buildings more expensive to build. So when that earthquake comes, very few people die. We want to get ready for potential wars. And so we do war simulations and try out, okay, who's going to be ready? What flaws might we have? In both the case of the pandemic and climate, you know, we can say our governments have not yet put enough resource into that. You know, I spoke out in 2015 after Ebola about the pandemic risk and saying we're not ready. And some things were done. The UK, Wellcome Trust, my foundation, Japan and Norway formed a group called CEPI, which has been the biggest funder of these coronavirus vaccines after the US government. The one category in this pandemic that the US gets good grade is they did deploy a lot of money for the vaccine very quickly. Now, in some ways, the pandemic and climate are different because the pandemic, as awful as it's been, you know, it's one innovation, the vaccine, will, as we get it out, you know, and make sure people feel comfortable with it, it will end this pandemic. With climate, the negative effects are, the super negative effects get worse and worse every year. And so the really bad stuff of, you know, natural ecosystems dying off and everybody near the equator not being able to work outdoors, so they have to migrate into other countries, that's more towards the end of the century that it gets super dire. And so getting people to take action now for something that's, you know, their kids and grandkids would have a tragic situation, that's more tricky. And we have to have cooperation, you know, because no matter where the emissions take place, it affects the entire world. So this is a tougher one, but, you know, people do expect government to show them and use innovation as the tool that can avoid the problem.
Well, look, Bill, I mean, I want to come and talk about governments because obviously they have a big role to play and we've had a change of administration in the US. But, you know, you're someone who learns about, you know, human challenges. You love that. You love taking on complicated problems. I mean, I remember this when I was running the Department for International Development in the UK government. I mean, I saw firsthand all the work that you were doing, all the work that your foundation was supporting in tackling the health challenges, and you talked about some of those in this session. Can you just explain to us, because I think people will be intrigued by this, what is your process for learning about something completely new? I mean, how do you go about it? How do you go about learning about climate change?
Yeah, so this is a great period for somebody who's curious. You know, you can go up and, you know, if you don't understand, hey, how is steel made? What's the history of that? You can read people like Smil, and, you know, he has books or online. The videos that educate you are incredible. I was lucky that a few professors, David Keith and Ken Caldera, agreed to spend 6 half-day sessions with me a year where we would pick different topics. And so I would read a few hundred pages in advance and sit and, you know, ask simple questions. And, you know, experts came in to explain about carbon capture and permafrost and ocean circulation and, you know, storage in the climate models and all these things that, you know, climate is the number of sciences that you need a grounding in to appreciate it is very, very large. And so for me, that's been fun, reading the different books, having people come in, and then, being able to build a team of people that, will talk with governments about what these policies are. And so, now I'm 15 years into it. And, the challenge was in writing the book to try and, make it approachable, because in a way, to engage everyone, we can't say that they have to go off and understand everything the experts do. But, I do think the younger generation has that commitment. And I think in schools, we can do even more that they can pursue that. We can do more with the online materials that are out there, as well as, bring the story of the potential downside, even the current suffering, because a lot of that, although you can see it now, in the US, in the UK, a lot of it's far away, but in the digital age, we should be able to make that accessible.
Yeah, and look, you're so right. I mean, this really matters for our generation, but of course, the future generations have. This evening just met with some really inspiring young people here in Kathmandu, talking about what they are doing to take their own actions on climate and how they're going about persuading the government. But look, Bill, you're a technologist, you're a philanthropist, you've got so many aspects of your work and your life. How does all this sort of intertwine when it comes to climate change? And I think you mentioned breakthrough energy. Can you talk a little bit more about the work that you've been doing through that?
Yeah, so it's very novel for the world to need innovation by a deadline. Normally we just let innovation go, and some areas go better than we expect, like chips, and some are much harder. And yet, now we, by 2050, if we don't get to zero, the temperature rise will be so damaging that, life will actually get worse for humans and most of the natural ecosystem. So you have to think, okay, how do you accelerate innovation? What is the pipeline of innovation? And we've got a slide that kind of shows this, that on the very left, we've got basic R&D, then we've got translational R&D. That's very much a government role, although philanthropists, like that seed work you and I were talking about, Lord Sainsbury's been an amazing backer of that work as well. Then, we can have money to draw people into the cause even before they can form a company. We call that fellows. So that's in this breakthrough energy umbrella. Then I mentioned the ventures group, which is funding these companies and as much as possible bringing in other funders as well. So we've raised 5 times as much money from other funders because our science team's ability to look and see what's good is trusted enough that it's helped unlock other money as well. And finally, there's that buying piece, which is government policies, tax credits, renewable energy standards. That's what we call catalysts. So in the case of solar, Japan and Germany drove the demand. In the case of offshore wind, the UK's playing that central role. So this is this pipeline. And, the goal is to have that green premium come down dramatically. And the bottom piece just says you need policy for every one of these things. You need global coordination and you need government policies. And so without government driving this, it's just not going to happen. Philanthropists can be helpful. They can drive some of the advocacy, but in the end, it's too big of a problem. And so that's why, the events like COP26 are so incredibly important.
Great, Bill. I'm going to ask you one more question before we move on to Q&A, which is that in the next few days, the Biden administration is going to rejoin the Paris Agreement. Certainly it's something that I very much welcome. And I welcome the fact that the US is back in the front line in the fight against climate change. But let me get your views on this. What do you think the new administration, the Biden administration, needs to do and to achieve on climate over the next 4 years?
Yeah, so it's fantastic that this is such a high priority for the Biden administration. I mean, he's articulated right up there with his work on the pandemic and equity issues. And you know, because it's such a hard problem, it requires that level of prioritization. He's picked super good people. You know, he's got John Kerry as his envoy, who's I've been talking to a lot because he has a lot of passion for the issue. But he's put climate people in throughout the administration. It's not just this vertical thing. Even, you know, like Brian Deese runs the Economic Council, has a very strong climate background. So I do think we'll get a lot of initiatives. I would say, though, a little bit ironically, we want climate to be a bipartisan issue because, you know, we've got to have 30 years of progress, not just 4 years. And one thing that is important is that the responsibility of the US and the UK is not just to drive their emissions to zero. Their responsibility is to make it easy for all countries to get to zero. And so that's why the reduction in that green premium is the best long-term metric of whether, you know, when we talk to India in 2050 and we say, India, please use green cement, green steel, will they say, hey, send us the trillions we'd need to subsidize that? Or will they say, okay, it's so modestly, only slightly more expensive that even with very little help externally, we agree that to help the world. In India, because they're closer to the equator, actually, these hot days and everything, it's actually worse for them than it is for most other countries. So they're kind of, both in terms of future emissions and future suffering, you know, India is paradigmatic. If we don't, you know, help them and get them involved, you know, then this whole thing doesn't go well. So, you know, driving innovation, the UK is super good at that. You know, it's emphasizing that that remains a super strong priority. The US, you know, and things like health research is by far the biggest spender, and we get a benefit that we have lots of companies that export those solutions. And so that paradigm we should apply to, you know, green innovation as well. So Biden's off to a very good start. And, you know, I think, you know, we can give the younger generation credit that in this political round, it was more discussed by far than at any time in our history.
Great. Thank you for that, Bill. So now we move on to the audience questions. And I've got a question here from David. And he says, here in the UK, much government strategy to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050 relies on carbon capture and storage, which I believe can only be a stepping stone to 2050 and must stop by then. What are your views on this technology?
Yeah, so I'm the largest investor in a variety of companies that are working on that. The key figure of merit is the cost per ton. You know, when you can capture carbon either from the output, say, of a cement or steel or power factory, and there it's like 15% of the gases coming out of the chimney. If you go out and just take the air that's blowing around, of course, right now it's 410 parts per million. So it's a little harder. One of the companies I'm funding is working with Occidental and thinks they can get down to $100 a ton. Now, $100 a ton is still pretty high. You know, if that's the only tactic you used, you take the $51 billion, you multiply by $100, that's $5 trillion a year, which is probably more than the world's likely to invest. I don't know how much below $100 we can get it. Can we get it to 50? You know, if you could get it down to 10 or 20, okay, that is mind-blowing. But I don't think very likely. You know, I hope some, you know, crazy thinker can prove me wrong and make me look foolish for saying that can't be done. But we can't count on it. But it is sort of the ultimate way that if you can't decarbonize a process, that you just do the direct air capture to offset it. But, you know, hopefully for most things, you don't have to use that because the cost per ton you know, I just don't see it being super, super low. You have to capture the carbon. You have to pressurize it. You have to put it underground somewhere where it's going to stay for a long time. Still fairly complex to do.
Thank you, Bill. And just my message to David is that please look at the 10-point plan for a green industrial revolution, which we published in our energy white paper. It'll tell you what else we're doing apart from planning on carbon capture and storage. So a question now from Julio, which is, what is the one thing that all of us can do to avoid a climate disaster? So us individually, I guess.
Yeah, so I'd say there's three things. There's your political voice and convincing people you know, even if their general politics are different than yours, you know, can you in a, you know, trustworthy, clear way, help bring them around to this cause? You know, that is very, very important. Parties can disagree on tactics to get to zero, but the fact that it's an important goal, we'd like to have that as a consensus as much as, you know, ending the pandemic is a consensus. The second thing is you as a consumer. If you buy an electric car, that helps drive the rate of innovation there up. You know, if you buy artificial meat, all the different products, you'll have clear indications of are there choices that have a lower carbon footprint, and you can be catalytic. We may even have a fund that you could give to, but you know, for now, you know, there's those clear categories. And then the final thing is you're an employee. And so saying to your company, hey, what are we doing in terms of our, you know, buying green aviation fuel or taking our skill sets, whether it's finance or tech and or anything else, and applying it, you know, even employees of the government buys a lot of stuff. You know, could it be 5% of the roads, you know, are built with clean cement, you know, and to try and drive that that forward. So because this is so hard, and because, you know, the 30 years, we can't waste any of them. We've got to be talking more about this. And, you know, it people who think you can only reduce your consumption, that alone will get us to zero. Sadly, you know, that's not going to help us because the developing countries, you know, need to provide basic services. So we've got to multiply by zero.
Yes, I think as you've said, basically we all have a role to play, whether it's governments or businesses or indeed individuals. So I have a question here from Albie, and she says, epidemiologists say COVID has been the most collaborative period of their lives. And this collaboration led to the rapid deployment of COVID vaccines. How do we catalyze this collaboration around climate change before the problem gets a lot worse?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. The, you know, sharing sequencing data where the UK got out in front on that. And, you know, our foundation's trials in South Africa showed how the variant affected that. You know, every day I wake up and see articles and, you know, people are being super open about everything. Even these pharma companies offering to let the Indian manufacturers have the vaccine. You know, that's really unprecedented that it's a second source factory with no royalty and just, you know, trying to help them get the volume up so that the inequity of how quickly we get the vaccine out, we can hopefully make that more like 6 months than 18 months. It's kind of a warlike attitude. Okay, we'll do whatever it takes. It's hard to sustain that, I have to say, for 30 years. Even, you know, like this year of, okay, we're going to stay in our home and we're not going to, you know, break any of the distancing rules. A year, you know, probably feels like a long time. With climate, you know, we need, you know, particularly these next 10 years to drive those innovations. I do think if we don't start to make progress, that sense of cynicism could come in, you know, or just people saying, hey, the brute force green premiums are just so high, why don't we just throw up our hands? So, you know, having every year or two something like Tesla and electric cars where you say, okay, I see now that this is real. We have to make that evident so that people feel very good about the progress that's taking place. So yeah, the openness, and that's where the basic R&D piece comes in, is that's just published to the world for everybody to see. And then, you know, when you actually try to build the plant, okay, that that's what gets you more into the private market side.
Yeah, so we definitely don't want to throw up our hands. We want to get on and do this. But James asks a really important question. He says, what do you think is the hardest political choice that nations need to make to help save the planet?
Well, unfortunately, there will be elements of this that are somewhat of a short-term sacrifice to get the long-term benefit. And, you know, being sensitive to the idea that, okay, if you work in the coal industry or, you know, you, farm cattle to make beef, you know, this effort feels like we're devaluing your skills and your, opportunity to contribute. The sensitivity to that will be super important. I mean, it's very interesting that in the UK, you can always look at what the current sources of energy are, and coal is tiny. So the irony that the place the Industrial Revolution started, which's very coal-driven, has actually made more progress than even some other European countries. You know, that just shows, hey, this can be done. A lot of our challenges with coal are in Asia. China's still building. India, the straightforward path to them is very coal-oriented. So it's great you're in Asia, where a lot of the potential for innovation will have to be brought there very, very quickly, so that their current plans, they see it as practical to make those changes. You know, we can't say there aren't trade-offs here. There are lots of new jobs, lots of new companies, but the right government policies to deal with which communities are affected. I've been really educated that if you don't have that as part of your plan, it's just not realistic to move forward on these things. And so that, you know, that means the price tag of doing the thing overall goes up quite a bit. It's a great investment in the future, but, you know, the transitional costs are there, and we have to be very open about that and say, look, you know, we're going to lead, we're going to make this worthwhile, including the, you know, the highly successful companies who are starting, like in finance and tech, starting to get into this. But, you know, I hope we see that intensify dramatically.
So, Bill, I mean, you're right in terms of coal. You know, we've gone in less than a decade from 40% to around 1%. In terms of use of coal in power in the UK. But you also talked about the future, and we've talked a lot about young people, and the future belongs to them, and they are absolutely committed to this cause. And we've got a question here from Claire. She says, as a high school science teacher, what is the best message we can send to the next generation?
Well, I think we can use climate change to get kids interested in science, and we can use science to get them interested in climate change. You know, to understand, okay, why does CO2 block the heat from coming out? And, you know, what would the Earth be like if we had zero CO2? It'd be too cold, actually. So, you know, some greenhouse gas effect actually has been very beneficial. You don't want too little or too much, particularly if it rises rapidly. The science teachers, you know, without being political about this, so that the solution, the specific policies for the solution will be separate, but just the basic understanding of what it means for things to heat up and how many hot days that will mean, you know, moving away from the equator to make summers almost unlivable well before the end of this century, I hope we can give materials. And in fact, Breakthrough Energy is working now on some core stuff that we were thinking like 13 or 14 year olds is a place that you could actually start to expose this and use their curiosity and fascination. So, you know, it's fascinating. And I do think people want to associate themselves with something more than just their own individual success. And so there's almost a religious commitment to the earth and, you know, what we're doing for future generations. And, you know, this cause, there aren't many causes that, you know, can draw the globe together, you know, where we work in a positive sum type way. And so, you know, the various youth organizations connecting up with each other and the best practices in the education system being shared, I think there's a lot to do there.
Yeah, and I mean, you will know this, but, you know, we've set up a civil society and youth advisory group as part of COP26 to help us, you know, on the road to COP26, get their views, get their thoughts. I think it's going to be so important and vital. But you talked a little bit about hydrogen earlier, and we talked about green hydrogen. And we've got a question here. It's from Anonymous. So I don't know who it is, but it's Anonymous. It says, what is your take on hydrogen and how crucial do you think it will be in achieving net zero?
It could play a very big role. You know, I emphasized how the manufacturing sector is the place we've made the least progress, even though it's the biggest overall source of emissions. Many of those manufacturing processes, if you could get clean green hydrogen that was very, very cheap, you know, then you, instead of making steel with coke, a form of coal, you would just do direct hydrogen reduction. Now, I want to emphasize it's not clear how cheap we can make green hydrogen. You have the capital cost of the plants that generate it, and you have the energy costs of either splitting water or pulling the hydrogen off of the methane. And those are the two primary ways. I am thrilled that over the last few years, the interest in green hydrogen is skyrocketing. I mean, 5 years ago, I think it was hardly talked about. I did one of my half-day sessions on green hydrogen just a month ago, and I was amazed at all the things that are going on there. And, you know, as part of the 10-point plan for the UK, as part of the recovery funds on the continent, you know, part of the Biden Build Back Better, I do think funding some of these green hydrogen plants and start to scale them up and try the different approaches, I'm very excited about that. But we always have to be realistic. It may not get cheap enough. Not everything we try and make really cheap, you know, can we overcome those physical limits, like, you know, magic grid batteries or batteries that you put into a plane so it can fly around. That's not, you know, those are not likely to happen. There's a UK company wants to put hydrogen into planes, which Breakthrough Energy just invested in that, although it's got a lot of challenges before it can be proven out. So yes, people should really pay attention to green hydrogen, because almost half of that manufacturing sector is solvable if that price is super, super low.
Great. Well, look, we had a question, Bill, from a high school teacher. And now, brilliantly, we have a question from Teddy, who is age 12. And we want more questions from young people coming in. And Teddy asks, what are the most effective actions that children and young people can do to address the climate crisis right now?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on advocacy. I have incredible admiration for people like Greta, who's, you know, really gotten visibility for the work she's doing. And I'm sure there's people around who are thinking about how they can scale up that message and make it constant. A lot of things come and, you know, people pay attention and then they move on. Sadly, in this case, you know, we need that attention to intensify and stay very, very high for all 30 years. And, you know, different parties may be in power in different countries, and yet, you know, we can't have them checking out of this cause. And so, you know, I'm not the one who knows the answer there, but, you know, young people coming together figuring out various tactics. Some are more extreme than others, and I don't know how to think about that myself. But it's this new generation will figure that out, and hopefully, we can help make sure that idealism gets mapped into real plans. Otherwise, 10 years from now, we could have a very cynical view of this thing.
Thank you for that. So now a question about entrepreneurship. And Frank asks, how can startup entrepreneurs contribute to tackling climate change?
Say again?
How can startup entrepreneurs, so you're starting out in your great career as an entrepreneur, what can you contribute to tackling climate change?
Yeah, I have to say that we need innovations from big companies and from startup companies. So far, it's mostly been the startup companies that go and cause trouble. And then the big companies wake up and go, oh, okay. So like the car industry, Tesla showed you can make a pretty darn good electric car. Now you have, General Motors announcing that after 2035, they're not even going to make gasoline cars. So it shows that we've come a long ways, and that extra cost of going green has come down phenomenally. These startups, they're high risk, but they're always looking for talented people. A lot of the skill sets are engineering. Some of them are marketing. Some of them are financial. So you could look on the Breakthrough Energy website and see examples of these. We probably need, 10,000 companies, of which hopefully over 1,000 of them succeed. But even the experience, if you're in a company that, isn't the ultimate success, it's a real contribution because we have to try out so many different approaches. Even green hydrogen, there's, besides the two main approaches underneath that, there's a ton of different things that people are trying, some of which seem crazy to me, but hopefully, one of those will surprise us that it works. So an attitude towards being willing to take risk, to be in there and, work in those small companies. That's one of the limits. And our fellows program is to fund people who, are in academia or at a big company and want a couple of years to pull together ideas even before they could get investors. And we have, hundreds of those now. And so that's trying to accelerate the IQ going to this super important problem.
Great. And look, we talked about behavioral change earlier, and we've got the Committee on Independent Committee on Climate Change in the UK, and they've made the point in one of their reports that actually a lot of this change will be delivered by how we change our own behaviours and actions. So John asks, how important do you see financial incentives as being for individuals to make those green decisions?
Well, I don't think we can fund that. I mean, we do put tax credits onto green products. I don't know the UK policies, but in the US there's a $7,500 tax credit for electric cars. And right now the electric cars aren't paying for the roads because that's done through a gasoline tax. And so that's also, in a sense, a subsidy that the roads are there without them having to pay for that. So, yes, that type of thing that will help bring the demand and bring up the scale, that's happened with solar in a significant way. I hope that consumers will just, decide, even if they have to pay a little bit extra, that the green products are a priority about who they are and how they contribute to this cause. But good tax policies connected to those products are also going to be very critical.
Thank you. Lucy asks a question. She says, how optimistic are you about humanity's chances? And I'm going to throw in something about COP26 as well. what, what, you know, how important, you've been to lots of previous COPs, you've been through this, you've been part of those discussions. How important is this year's COP in Glasgow?
Yeah, I'd say that it's really critical because 30 years is a very limited period of time. I mean, given the scale of the industrial economy, if in 10 years we don't have clear approaches so that we get that 20 years to actually start replacing steel and cement plants or upgrading them in an appropriate way, you know, then I get a bit pessimistic if that path isn't clear over this next decade. So particularly for the rich countries in driving those things, the consensus, the coordination, you know, we don't have extra time left. Paris was great because although a lot of it was the near-term goals, we did show a collective willingness to come together and countries to put resources into their reductions and to encourage each other. You know, in the US, some people say, well, if the other countries don't do it, why should we? Well, yes, that kind of cynical view actually is somewhat legitimate. So people should see in COP26 that it's even more than Paris. You know, a few countries may not have that 2050 goal yet. China's talking about 2060. We hope that over time that they'll pull that in, that they'll speak about being less involved with coal in some ways. You know, so they're super important. You know, the fact that Biden's, you know, viewing this as a critical event for himself. The idea of getting innovation even more clearly on the agenda, including this catalytic bind part of it. You know, I'm thrilled that the UK is taking it so seriously. You know, I think because the UK set a good example, that everyone, you know, will come in wanting to show stronger commitment.
Thank you again to the Jaipur Literary Festival for hosting us today and to our viewers from Jaipur and across the whole of India. Thank you, Bill, for your time. It's been a fascinating discussion. To everyone, please have a great rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please subscribe or follow to this show wherever you're listening to this.